I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Swedish chef and photographer Magnus Nilsson, who is currently head chef at the restaurant Faviken in Sweden. He's joined in conversation by Adam Sachs, former editor-in-chief of Savur. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Magnus Nilsson and Adam Sachs. Magnus Nilsson is not only one of the world's best chefs, with his restaurant Faviken frequently named as one of the best restaurants in the world. He is also an incredible expert on the food cultures and traditions of the entire Nordic region, an accomplished author, and a remarkable photographer. He has done a truly incredible thing in this book, The Nordic Baking Book, and its earlier companion, The Nordic Cookbook, which, believe it or not, is even bigger than this one. He spent 6 years traveling all around the Nordic region, Denmark, the Faroe Islands, Finland, Greenland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden, collecting recipes and documenting the landscape to write these two books. He created a website and asked people to submit recipes. He spent time with grandmothers and with home cooks learning about their traditions, following connections to agriculture and tracing how recipes changed over the region. He collected over 11,000 recipes, notes, and articles and took over 8,000 photographs. He takes us on a journey from flatbreads to Kringles, potato crackers to Danish buns and porridge, and through it all teaches us all about the history of the region, its farming and agriculture, its trade, and the similarities and diversity found in this area that encompasses over 1 million square miles. Magnus once said, "A lot of the things that are past, they are becoming extinct or are getting forgotten. My job is to keep the original alive in a way that people can understand." He does this every day at Faviken and has given us a remarkable gift in spending 6 years of his life and creative energy in writing these books as a documentary tribute to the rich food culture and traditions of his region. Magnus will share stories and photographs with us, and then we'll be joined in conversation by Adam Sachs, former editor-in-chief of Savur. Now please join me to welcome Magnus Nilsson and Adam Sachs.
Thank you so much for coming here tonight, and a big thank you to the JCC for having us here tonight as well. I've written this book, The Nordic Baking Book, and it's the end of a six-year process that after 3 years resulted in The Nordic Cookbook and now finishes with this book. And it's been incredibly interesting for me, as a Swedish person, a person living in the Nordics, to get to spend this much time learning about my own culture, a culture that I thought I knew a lot about, and it turned out that I didn't know as much about at all as I thought in the beginning. And the purpose of these two books, it's really to try to explain to the world what Nordic food culture and baking culture looks like today. Because I think that the culture of eating and baking in my home region is one of the most misunderstood cultures in the whole world. And it's largely my own fault. I mean, if you type Nordic cooking into Google, you will get first like 1,000 articles about Noma, Faviken, and like 4 other restaurants. and none of them are very representative of how we actually eat in the Nordics. And then after that, you'll get a bunch of recipes for gravlax, meatballs, pickled herring, and cinnamon buns. And they're all great and they're all Nordic, but that's not what we eat every day either. And then lastly, if you picture Google, you will get like a lot of people photographing their meatball portion from IKEA, which is kind of great. Now, so I felt that there is a real need for these books. And something that I've learned during the second half of this process, working on the baking part of the project, is that there is just so much more diversity in the region than I would ever have expected. And I've actually come to the conclusion that there is no greater and more diverse baking culture on the planet today. And this might sound a little bit less than obvious to most people, and I'm going to try to spend like the next 30 minutes or so making my case to why this is true. And then me and Adam are going to talk a little bit. The best place to start when you talk about culture, it's the people. Because without people, there is no culture, baking or other. And the Nordic region, it's inhabited by about 26 million people, and they're spread out over a surface area of just under 3.5 million square kilometers. This means an average of 7.5 person per square kilometer. And this is, I mean, by no stretch they can be characterized as particularly densely populated, right? We can compare it to the whole rest of Europe without the Nordics, which would, in the same way, have 90 people per square kilometer, a lot more. And it gets even more interesting when you get into the separate countries. France, 116 people per square kilometer. And then Germany, the most populous nation in Europe, 237 people per square kilometer. So if you take all of the Germans and you just spread them out in an even layer all across their country, you get one German per 75 meters in every direction. If you do the same in the Nordic region, you have 375 meters between all of us. It's a huge difference. So we have this vast geographical area with a very scarce population. And, I mean, if we were to go back, let's say, a couple of hundred years to a time when a lot of what we would consider our cultural identity of today was actually founded, what do you guys think that this sort of scarcity of population would have meant for the way that knowledge is transmitted between people? Can I get some suggestions?
Infrequent.
Really difficult, yeah. I think that sort of sums it up pretty well, actually. I mean, this is obviously pre-television and cell phones and social media and everything. And I think that, I mean, information everywhere was simply transmitted at a much lower pace back then than it is today. You had to just talk to someone in person, face to face, to acquire whatever information they might have that you are interested in. Or you had to, like, write a letter. And that's, you know, I love letters, but it's a very, very slow way of exchanging information. Not very efficient. And the third possibility, if you wanted to learn from a trusted source about, for example, baking, I mean, it was to read a book. And back then, there were like three books, the Bible, and then two more, which was not on baking at all. So, I mean, if we can kind of agree that information would have flowed a lot slower everywhere because of the lack of technology, I think we can also very easily imagine that in an area as scarcely populated as the Nordic region, this effect would have been even further exaggerated, simply because it's just, you know, harder to get face-to-face with people. And this is very important for my reasoning and something that I'm going to get back to a little bit later. And now I'm going to do an example to illustrate this. Adam. So tomorrow, Adam is going to invent a new recipe for cake. And it's not just any cake. It's actually the most delicious cake that's ever been invented by humankind. Revolutionary. Very delicious. And, I mean, he'll bake it. He will have a little taste himself. He will feel very content about his new cake because it is very delicious. He will share it with his family. They are going to be really happy to eat it because it is very delicious. And what people do today when they feel a sense of accomplishment is to share this information, usually by social media. So chances are that Adam is going to post about his new cake recipe on his Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or whatever. And the information is going to reach a few more. You know, and I mean, he's a trusted source. So his claim that this is the most delicious cake ever invented by humankind, it's probably going to lead to at least a few people being intrigued enough to actually ask him for the recipe. And they're going to bake it. And they're also going to be really happy because the cake is very delicious. And they're also going to share it. And all of a sudden, you're going to, you know, continue this sort of generations of sharing the recipe for this new and revolutionary cake. And then maybe you hit someone that has a little bit more reach, and you reach more people and more people and more people. And all of a sudden, it's featured on Martha Stewart Living, Adam's cake. And then the end of this month, end of November, is my birthday. And back home in Sweden, Tove, my wife, she's making a birthday cake. But it's not the normal birthday cake, not the green marzipan layer cake, the princess cake, which is my favorite birthday cake. No, no, it's a new recipe. But it's actually not Adam's recipe. No, it's the vegan raw food version of Adam's recipe that Tove got from her Goop newsletter. And I mean, that's sort of how it works today, you know? So within just a couple of weeks, a new piece of information about, let's say, baking culture can reach pretty much all across the globe. It can reach an enormous amount of people, and it also mutates really quickly along the way into new versions and iterations of itself. And if we were to compare this to how it used to be back in the old days, I mean, at the Sachs homestead, the same cake it would have been invented, the same sense of satisfaction and accomplishment, it would have been shared with the family, and, you know, that would have been it for a while. Pretty much until perhaps Adam's kids would have left home and, you know, gotten married with someone on the next homestead, 800 meters away, 20 years later. So, you know, after a significantly longer amount of time, the revolutionary cake recipe, the mother of all cakes, would have reached, you know, 8 people in a diameter of 2 kilometers, roughly. And this is obviously a bit of an over-exaggeration, but I think you get the point. I mean, and to put this simply, a scarce population spread out over a vast area used to mean, and to some extent still does mean, that knowledge travels slower. And this, in its turn, it will mean that you'll get much more varied expressions of all commonly practiced culture, simply because people are less influenced by each other, and therefore they do less of the same stuff. And this is one reason to why the Nordic region has a much more diverse baking culture than anywhere else. Another reason, which is also somewhat related to the scarcity of population and which really influences the baking culture, it's the role of bakeries in society. And in the Nordics, baking culture, it's not carried primarily by bakeries, but rather by people in their homes. Not just in the past, but also today. And, I mean, why do you guys think this is? What does bakery need to sustain themselves? They need customers. And, I mean, as I said before, we have on average one every 375th meter. So there are not so many. And, I mean, there are definitely bakeries in the Nordics, but mostly they are in the cities. And the cities are few and far apart. And they're mostly located in quite a small part of the region. It will be sort of this is sort of southern third of Sweden, the country of Denmark, a little bit in the southwest of Finland, around Helsinki and up the coast, and then it would be around Oslo and a bit up the coast of Norway. That would have been where you would have had significant enough populations to sustain bakeries in sort of more historical times. I actually did a little test. a few weeks ago, I was talking on a completely different subject, so I didn't influence the audience. And I asked them, I knew that I was going to do this, so I asked them a little question. And that question was what they thought was the greatest baking culture on the planet. So what do you think they said? France. Yeah, they didn't say Nordic. None of them said Nordic. And which was shocking, you know. There were 100 of them in the room. It was 99 of them said France, and then there was this one guy who said Austria. And it kind of made me think a little bit, because I think that I would have said France too before I started with this project. And I started to think about why, you know. I think that this is simply a great example of a very clever and successful branding exercise carried out by the French. I mean, you visit France, you buy a baguette, you buy an eclair, and it's like all fantastic, you know? But if we start to look a bit more deeply into what French baking culture actually is, It's like the polar opposite of the Nordic one. As opposed to ours, French baking culture is almost entirely driven by professional bakeries. People in France, they don't bake much at all at home. And I mean, why would they? There's a bakery in every little tiny village in France. And the country is densely populated, and it's very evenly populated, so there are tiny little villages with tiny little bakeries everywhere, you know? Historically, there wouldn't have been much incentive to produce your daily bread as a staple in the home. But if we take this a bit further and sort of analyze a little bit what this means for the diversity of culture. I mean, I imagine that many of you in this room, perhaps even most of you, you would have been to France, perhaps bought something from a French pastry or a French bakery. Perhaps you were there on vacation, or perhaps you lived there for a while. I think that most of us can agree that French bakeries are lovely. I mean, they're great. The baguette, butter croissant, pain au chocolat, apricot turnovers, flan, pain au raisin. I mean, all of these are examples of great things. And I too love a French bakery. I used to live there. I've been to a lot of French bakeries. In fact, I've been to a lot of French bakeries all across the country. And what's very striking is that they're kind of all the same. They have almost exactly the same repertoire, regardless of geographical location, within this fairly large country. Sure, the butter rolled into the croissants up north in Brittany, it might be a little bit salter than the butter outside of Nice. Perhaps the apricots are fresh in the south and canned in the north, and there are definitely some regional variations and some regional specialties that are sort of added on to this standard repertoire. But all in all, they are remarkably similar. And as I said before, in France, people rarely bake at home. And if they do, it would most often be for dessert, not really for bread. And the thing, as you might understand now with me talking about it, is that bakeries don't really promote cultural individuality and diversity. And this is because they are businesses. And businesses, they have to function financially to be able to stay open. And this happens when you find this sweet spot between what people want to buy and pay for and what's possible to produce in an efficient enough manner. And there's a lot of circumstances in every type of business that would dictate what's possible and not. And these circumstances, they tend to streamline the process and the possibilities for any type of business. And very often, we forget that this also applies to businesses in food, and especially we tend to forget that it applies to small businesses in food as much as it does to larger examples of manufacturing. And I think it's sort of, you can make an example here, you can make a parallel with the car companies. I mean, we have quite a few of those. Not as many as we have bakeries, but they are on the other hand bigger, so it's still interesting. I mean, except for some small cosmetical differences. They pretty much do the same thing, don't they? You know, rectangular box, a wheel in each corner, a thing that goes in that direction or that direction, you know. They share a lot of similar characteristics, and it's the same reason that they do this as it is that the bakers in France have a very similar repertoire. That's what the market wants, and it's in combination with what's possible to produce. And also, most bakeries, I mean, they're run by bakers. And these bakers, they've gone to school somewhere. And in school, they've learned how to bake. And incidentally, they learned to bake pretty much exactly the same stuff as all of the other people who went to school to learn to bake, learned how to bake. And this is, in most cases, also what they're going to teach the next generation of bakers coming after them about baking, because it worked for them, right? So in baking cultures driven by bakeries, you will almost inevitably have only a fraction of the diversity found in cultures driven by people baking at home. And this is another reason why there is no more diverse baking culture in the world than the Nordic.
You're listening to chef and photographer Magnus Nilsson, who is currently head chef at the restaurant Faviken in Sweden, and whose latest book is The Nordic Baking Book. He's joined in conversation by Adam Sachs on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And I think here, actually, a small comparison between the U.S. and Sweden really illustrates the difference in how much people actually bake at home. Because one thing that I noticed very early on with this book, when we started sending out recipes to recipe testers in different parts of the world, was that it's very difficult to buy fresh yeast here. To the point where if you want to get some fresh yeast, you have to sort of sneak up some back alley and into the back door in a bakery and try to beg and buy some of their yeast stash. This is very different from Sweden, for example, where you can buy fresh yeast in every grocery store, every supermarket, every 7-Eleven, and every petrol station, and many newsstands even carry fresh yeast. And this is obviously not just because they're like really brightly colored, beautiful little cubes. It's because people buy them, and they buy them because they want to bake with them. And we can also have a look at the geography and climate, because this is another very important influence on what people eat. Even today, when we move produce around in every which direction, the way people used to have to eat, it influences the way we choose to eat a lot. And as I said before, the Nordics, it's a vast region. From the southernmost bit in Denmark to the furthest north of the Spitsbergen Islands, north of Norway, from Finland in the east to Greenland all the way in the west. It's a huge area. You can fit all of the rest of Europe a whole bunch of times in there. You can also fit the US in there. And sure, a lot of this is ocean, so no one lives there. But it kind of doesn't really matter, because what matters when it comes to cultural diversity is actually the distance between the extremes where people live, much more than having an equivalent amount of people spread out over an even area. And in terms of climate, naturally, you will have a vast variation in such a large area, many, many different climate zones. And this, in its turn, it will mean that what people have been able to grow in the past and thereby bake with and integrate into our food culture is varied a lot between different parts. You can take wheat, for example. Wheat is a grain that needs pretty particular circumstances to function well as a crop. It needs to have warm enough summers, long enough summers, it needs to have quite a lot of water, and it needs to have very, very rich and fertile soil to produce a great crop. And those circumstances, you don't really find them in many parts of the Nordic region. And where you find good growing conditions for wheat, it incidentally coincides exactly with where all of those cities were located that I talked about before. And incidentally, it's also where you'll find most of the traditional breads based on wheat. And then you can look at other parts of the Nordics. Let's say Denmark alone. So Denmark has the most fertile grounds of the Nordic region, the best climate for farming. They have all of that. And they grow a lot of wheat, and they've done it for a long time. But they didn't really eat most of it themselves, because wheat has always been a very expensive trade commodity as well. So most of the wheat historically was just sold to Central Europe. And on the poorer soils in Denmark, rather than wheat, which wouldn't grow there, they would grow rye. Because rye, it ripens reliably every summer in a climate like the one in Denmark. And they kept the rye for themselves. So in Denmark, you will, in addition to those wheat breads, you will also have a great rye baking tradition. And because of this, and because of the fact that Denmark and Sweden, South Sweden, are very close together geographically, in both South Sweden and Denmark, you will find quite a few breads that are baked with a mix of rye and wheat, which you don't really find anywhere else in the Nordic region. And then Finland. So most of Finland, it's too cold in the summer to grow wheat. So they grow rye there. And the southern bit, and the bit towards Russia, it has inland climate, and the summer is too dry there for wheat to grow, even if it's warm enough. But rye, it can take a lot less water to ripen well. So they grow rye almost all of the whole country, And this is the reason why Finland almost don't have a wheat baking culture. It's almost entirely rye-based. If we look at the northern parts of Scandinavia, like northern parts of Sweden, where I'm from, it's too cold in the summers to grow both rye and wheat. Doesn't work. So people used to grow oats or barley. And oats, it doesn't have any gluten in it at all, and barley has very little gluten. So the further north you get in Scandinavia, the flatter the breads, you know? Because you need to have gluten to make fluffy breads. To the point where you reach sort of where I grew up, where it's pretty much only flatbreads, either soft or hard flatbreads. Once again, I'm going to compare this to France, just because it compares so well. What grain do they have in France? What's the predominant grain there? Well, it's wheat. It's just wheat. It's wheat, wheat, wheat everywhere. And why would it be anything else? I mean, it's the most well-paid for grain that you can grow in Europe, at least in historical times. So anyone who has soil that can grow wheat will probably do that. But this also informs their baking culture. And if you look at all of those French breads that we just talked about, what are they based from? They're based from wheat. And naturally, I mean, the climate and its limiting factors has created a lot of diversity in the Nordic region. And instead of one single grain that dominates all of baking culture, we have four that were all equally important in different parts of the region. And this is another reason why Nordic baking culture has more variations in breads and cakes and cookies and buns than any other baking culture. And as I said before, the Nordic region is vast, but it's also a vast area that's almost entirely located in the marginal climate. And marginally for people to successfully live there, that is, I mean, it's a climate where, I mean, you can't just, you know, in historic times, you couldn't just move in there and expect to be able to harvest plant-based foods all year around, like you would in large parts of the Mediterranean, for example, in the Southeast Asia, and many other warmer climates. And the interesting thing is that all marginal climates in the whole world, they have two product groups in common, which have had huge historical importance and essentially made people live through the harsh winters. And those product groups, there are grains and dairy. And both grains and dairy, they are not only high in energy, but they're also very easy to produce in large quantities during a relatively cool summer. And on top of that, they're also very easily prepared for storage. I mean, you think for milk, it's like cultured dairy, it's butter, it's cheese, you know, things that keep really well. And on top of that, things that are very dense in energy, so they take up very little storage space. And then for grains, I mean, pretty much all of the seeds of perennial grasses, they dry really well, they store really well, and they can be turned into a lot of different things. When I've traveled around, it's fascinating to see how accurate this is. And it doesn't matter if you're visiting like a village in the Peruvian Andes, if it's a monastery in Bhutan in the Himalayas, or if it's sort of suburban Stockholm, you know. When you start talking to people and you look at what they eat today by choice and what they had to eat in the past if they lived there, it's just fascinating to see that it doesn't matter if it's corn, red rice, or wheat, or if it's milk from llama or yak or cow. But these two product groups, they've played a huge role. And I think that baking, which is actually, as I learned by making this book, very hard to define, you know, what baking actually is. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that baking is simply the term for all of the ways of making stored grains, plain in many cases, but often in combination with dairy, into products that are more easy to eat, more tasty, more easily digested for us, and more varied than, you know, just the base products themselves. And I think that the fact that we've created so much variation with such a limited range, limited number of base products as we have in baking, you know, if you compare to savory cooking, where you have thousands of different raw materials going into various recipes, whilst with baking you have, you know, pretty much all baking recipes contain like the same six things in different quantities and variations. I think that says a lot about how big a part of our caloric intake that used to be made up of baked goods, because otherwise we would never have been motivated to create such a variation. And today we tend to tell ourselves that we decide what we eat, you know, that no one else influences what I put in my mouth. No one else dictates what products we buy and what we make from them. And I think this is completely wrong. I mean, we are animals, all of us. We do exactly what our species has always done. We procure products that make sense of us and that are available at the moment, and then we process them in whatever way we've been taught by our ancestors or by other trusted sources. And then we eat them either alone or with our flock. I mean, that's what we do. And the thing that fascinates me so much with all of this is the degree and the amount of cultural knowledge that we sort of, without thinking about it, transfer from generation to generation. And eating correctly grown, preserved, stored, and subsequently prepared foods, it used to be incredibly important for our ancestors. To them, that was simply about survival. And I mean, survival is, as we know, the single strongest motivating force of the human being. For us today, eating breads, cakes, buns, cookies, and whatever else we've baked, it's mostly about pleasure, right? But why do we find baking and baked goods so pleasurable? And the easy explanation here, the one that we hear all of the time, is that we're hardwired to crave foods that are dense in energy, which most baked goods are. But I don't think that it's that simple, because that only you know, explains why we enjoy eating a cookie. It doesn't explain why we enjoy baking a cookie. And I asked a lot of people this, and I've looked a lot about how I feel about cooking as well and baking, and remarkably often people seem to take more pleasure in baking than in cooking. I mean, I think that I have, you know, I reach sort of a higher level of self-satisfaction when I've baked a cake than when I've made an omelette, for example. And I've actually made a little observation since this book came out. So I almost never get tagged by people on Instagram that have made dishes based on my recipes from the Nordic cookbook. It happens like once a month, twice a month. Since this book came out, it is like 20 a day who tag me, and they made like buns and cookies and cakes and biscuits and, you know, all kinds of things. And I think this says a lot about our sense of self-satisfaction when we bake. And I think that the reason for this is simply that it's, you know, our minds making sure subconsciously that we don't lose this information that used to be vital for our ancestors to have, how to process grains into tasty food, that we don't lose that between generations simply by making it so pleasurable that everyone wants to do it. And I think this sort of boils down to my final big reason to why the Nordic baking culture truly is the greatest and most diverse around. I mean, preparing grains in this way, it used to be more important where I come from than almost anywhere else in the world. And therefore, regardless if we want to or not, I think that Nordic people enjoy baking a little bit more than almost anywhere else in the world as well. And therefore, I mean, a culture which is constantly in use and constantly allowed to change because it's being practiced all the time, it will always be broader and deeper and more diverse than one which isn't, you know, than one which is static. So, thank you. Adam.
See you. All right, that's a hard act to follow, and you're still part of this act, so that's good. I wrote down a lot of insightful questions. I'm going to pick one at random to start. Who was the first American journalist to write a sizable story about you that really set you on your path and kind of set you up for success here in probably what I assume is your largest book buying market? What's that?
He was Kate Crader.
No.
No, it was Adam.
Yeah, okay, got that out of the way. So I think if you're familiar, if you're here, you're probably a little bit familiar with Favikin, with the backstory, if you've seen Chef's Table, if you've read a little bit about Magnus. I'd love to get into sort of for you, the kind of beginnings of your awareness of where you were, you know, you as one person in 300-something square meters, growing up in the north, inland in Sweden, you talk early in the book about that you were sort of introduced to this idea of four grains, and they were kind of the centrality of these four grains. And you say that, you write that all modern cereal crops are in fact the seeds of grasses, regardless of whether we're talking about corn, rice, or wheat. Without them, and without the combination of them, human eagerness, which is a great phrase, to solve problems, there would be no baking and probably no civilization, for that matter.
No, so that's true.
How did you first kind of come across these four grains, and what role do they play in your imagination about the food you were exposed to as a kid?
I mean, when I grew up, I thought that there were only four grains, because that's... I mean, we weren't exactly taught in school that there were only four grains, but no one told us about the other grains.
They left out that.
And there was a lot of focus of, you know, grains being like, you know, the stuff to eat. When I grew up, the recommendation from the Food and Health Safety Board in Sweden was still that six slices of bread a day was like a good target, you know?
Just a baseline.
Yeah, like a baseline. The liter of milk,
yeah.
You know?
Well, that's interesting, because you talked...
That's why we were so tall, all of us.
tall and wide. You talk in the book, you address a kind of common cliche about baking versus savory cooking, let's call it. You say that everyone always tells me that baking is a science and cooking is more of an art. And then you basically say that that's nonsense.
It's very silly. I mean,
what do you mean?
I think it's actually like with all things that people don't understand fully. Instead of like trying to understand, most of us dismiss it by labeling things with something.
Yeah.
And it's like you look at this great painting, for example, and you meet the artist and you see the artist in the distance, and you're on a show in a gallery, and then you say to your friend that, you know, he must be such a creative person who made that. But maybe he's not. Maybe he's just really good at painting, you know? It's just that you didn't understand how he did it, and then he's a creative guy.
Right.
And it's sort of the same thing, you know? Things that we don't quite get, we like to, like, you know, label them with sort of some kind of casual phrase.
Some
mythology,
and we make them a little more mysterious. Because
yeah,
you don't have to deal with them,
you know?
Right.
It's science, it's fine.
But
it's art.
You write, I think what they're trying to imply is that in cooking you can be a bit more playful when you follow recipes, while in baking... you have to follow them to the letter. I don't think this is true. This is a very Magnus statement, which is, you've already seen. I don't think this is true at all. Baking and cooking are just the same.
Yeah.
So what aren't we getting about baking? That it's if we know, is it like jazz? You know the rules. You can riff on it and kind of play against the rules, or what are we missing?
I don't know. I mean, baking is kind of fascinating like that, because it's, of all of the fields of cooking, it has the lowest sort of entry point, because most of the recipes are very well produced,
mm-hmm.
because of this reason that you're talking about, actually.
Right.
So if you just follow a well-made baking recipe to the dot, I mean, you will get something nice out of it. And on the other hand, baking is the most difficult field in cooking to become intuitive in, I think.
Right.
I mean, most people, even those who don't cook very much, they can taste something and it's like, oh, this needs a bit more salt, you know?
Yeah.
Or this one is too thick, I'll add a bit more water.
Yeah.
There's not that many people who can like whip up a batter for, you know, sponge cake and it's like, I think this needs a bit more flour.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's not very common. And why that is, I don't know. If it's just that we... like in our daily lives, is practice so much more on cooking than we do in baking, or if there is something else.
But you make a couple of points in the book, I think, that you notes that you hit repeatedly. One is simply just to keep doing it, and then also to trust your eyes. If you say in the book, you know, the dough should be wet and it's not, don't just go ahead.
Yeah.
But I think that's a big hurdle, because yeah, you can taste, you know, if you're making an omelet, it may not come out perfectly, but you sort of know if it needs more salt. And with baking, I think, is it just that we don't do enough of it?
I don't know. I mean, I think it might have to do also with this idea that baking is science, that you have to follow the recipes.
Right.
Because otherwise some great disaster is going to strike you. But mostly it doesn't. Usually the only thing that happens is that something gets either a little bit more good or a little bit less good than
right.
the, you know, intended version.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is chef and photographer Magnus Nilsson, who is currently head chef at the restaurant Faviken in Sweden, and whose latest book is The Nordic Baking Book. He's joined in conversation by Adam Sachs. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So you talk about the recipes in the book and the process, and maybe you could go into the process a little bit deeper, that it's a documentary cookbook. So that, as you're describing in your talk, that this was, you didn't just sort of, these aren't, you know, Magnus's versions of top 20.
There's one recipe that's mine of, in the whole book.
Should we guess which one? Or
yeah,
is
you
it
can
say?
Guess if you want to.
Oh, it's is it the
soft Swedish flatbread? Is my family recipe.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right. I'm just going to forget
there
that.
There are two recipes in the book.
So talk about that. So you talk about in flatbreads that there are two distinct kinds of flatbreads. That there's soft and hard, and soft is essentially what you're eating in the moment, and hard is what you're aging. Is that growing up? Do both of those play a role in a kind of daily Swedish diet?
Yeah, they do.
Diet?
They do. Especially, I mean, the soft ones, they play the role in my daily life when I grew up, because we have freezers now. So you would freeze them after baking. Traditionally, they would only be eaten okay. a day or two after the day you baked. And
yeah.
you bake flatbreads maybe four times a year.
Yeah.
So most of the time it was hard.
So you would freeze them.
Yeah. But in like the daily diet of Swedes and Norwegians and to some extent Finns, not the Danes, they do it differently. But in these three countries, I mean, the different hard flatbreads and like hardtack and crisp rolls and stuff like that has a really big role. And it's something that's served with every meal, like every meal.
Every meal. So up north you're saying remote, empty, barren wasteland where you have all your breads are flat. But even in Stockholm and in yeah. sort of more bountiful
yeah,
regions,
yeah, absolutely. And it would be like, I mean, it would be that, and potatoes would be like the daily carbohydrate staple.
Yeah.
So my grandparents, for example, I mean, they would have potatoes with everything. I mean, it would be, you know, spaghetti bolognese and then potatoes and hardtack.
Yeah.
So it's like,
that's amazing. That's what we think of Swedish food. It's
yeah.
amazing that. It wasn't voted higher than the French. speaking of spaghetti bolognese, we've talked about, I think, spaghetti bolognese and lasagna. And if you go to Faviken and you're lucky enough to go back in the kitchen, I haven't been there in a while. I was there before the grand expansion. It was a 12-seat restaurant.
Exactly.
Now they've
24.
Massively expanded to 24 seats. So it's changed. It's changed. I like, you know, I was there in a
you
different,
like the
different
small
era.
Formats,
different
yeah.
era. Yeah. But you all would have pineapple pizza as your staff meal.
We
once
like
a week
that. Yeah, we do.
But you there's a note that you strike in the book that's very comforting, but slightly maybe contradictory to me, and I want you to explain it. Where you say that cuisine is not static; that the you know of the food of a region or you know a country or an area never stays the same, and it's good to mix it up a little bit. If you want to double the cardamom in a roll recipe, go ahead if it makes you happy. Or if you don't like cardamom, you know, put in ketchup or whatever you think Americans would put in. But so you, on the one hand, you say kind of have at it, and it and everything is fair game. And on the other hand, you produce, this is your second, you know, massive book, which is a document of kind of cuisine as it is. Hmm. So where do you fall on that?
It's very easy to adopt an opinion when you work in food and you're passionate about food, that all of these immediately appealing, often very cute, slightly exotic food cultural traditions that are on the brink of extinction, that they should be preserved in a bubble.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had some really ferocious discussions with like the slow food people about this.
Yes. There's some very, very boring conversations you can have about yeah. around authenticity, and they're also
but
important.
But the thing with this is that what I've kind of come to understand is that you can't do that, because people are going to eat right. what makes sense there and then. You can't force traditions to stay active. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
And this is just something that we figure out now, like the last 30 years, that all of these traditions deserve to you know, remain static in eternity. And the only thing I think we should do is to make sure that we record and document what's right. there, because it's a great waste and pity when knowledge that's been, you know, amassed over generations and sometimes thousands of years just sort of disappears because we stop practicing. But it's like, I take the example of Swedish sour herring, surströmming, the officially the stinkiest food in the whole world.
Worse than durian? No, worse.
It's like
more intense.
Durian is like, you know, it's a fruit. This is a fish. It's like, I mean, you know. But
fair enough.
So the funny thing with sour herring, it's like the people think that it's an ancient dish, which is not. I mean, it's intensely tied to industrialization because it relies entirely on being re-fermented in a tin can, so it didn't exist before industrialization. And less and less people eat it now. And at some point, I mean, this trend is going to continue. I don't eat it, and I have no intentions of teaching my kid how to eat it.
You don't like it?
No, I don't like it. Yeah. I mean, I like that it's there, and I think it's an interesting historical document, but I think it's absolutely terrible to eat. And I mean, it's fine. With other people might like this. You know, it's okay. But so at some point, you're going to hit a point where it becomes unsustainable for these factories to produce sour herring. And because it's a process entirely reliant on factories to exist, you can't make sour herring at home. It will never be sour herring.
Right.
It will just be some other weird fermented fish, you know? And then, I mean, it will just cease to exist overnight. And I think that this is going to happen within 30 years.
Yeah.
And after that, there will be no sour
herring. We're all worried about it.
I, you know, the only thing I want is that it gets properly documented. And
document
then when it ceases to exist,
file it away, celebrate it,
yep.
And never have to eat it. Well, can you fill in? I thought it was fascinating. I mean, your pitch for Scandinavian pastries baking being the you know the dominant one in the world is charming and a little bit jingoistic and interesting, but. Fill in. I want to challenge you a little bit about that because
you're charming.
if you talk about the variety, but isn't one of the reasons? I mean, if you are in a culture where there's more competition, there's more iteration, there's more improvement. Most of your neighbors don't know all of these pastries or all of these cakes or breads exist, and so the reason that there's this variety is that they are, as you said, sort of spread out and far from each other, and they kind of stay alive. And, you know, the example of you know, my you know, big cake that I'm going to make famous, it stays there and it doesn't change. But aren't cultures that do sort of push the evolution of it, aren't they maybe making things more delicious in theory?
I mean, I mean, delicious is just a point of opinion. And I think that there is a very common misconception about culture, that it's something that we actually control what it is. I mean, culture is just the sum of whatever we do anyhow.
People doing stuff,
it's like,
yeah.
It's not the other way around.
Right.
I mean, I work to make things more delicious. But as we talked about before, the book is not about that. And I mean, I haven't figured out any way of judging the greatness of culture except diversity. Because to me, there is no cultural expression that's better than another culture. It's just culture. It's like, I mean, and this is sort of something, because on a personal level, I mean, I can obviously have a preference for certain things. I mean, I like your burger at home more than I like, let's say, McDonald's.
Right.
But culturally speaking, I mean, none is better than the other.
Right. And I'm joking about this a little bit, but it does. And so but fill in that picture a little bit. How do these individual sort of remote islands of tradition, before you go out and call around and cast about for, you know, recipes, how do they stay alive? I mean, in what you're describing of these communities where the cake can only reach 20 people or the bread can't make it very far, how did they stay alive? Was it that the
people ate
when
this, you know, people ate as much as they do today, a bit less perhaps, but you know, generally speaking, and I mean that's the thing, we all eat. That's why culture, like food culture, is the most important cultural expressions that we have in humanity, because we all eat, and we all eat something.
Yeah,
and I mean one thing that's very interesting though is that, I mean, I think almost all of us, at least in the West, we eat a more varied diet now than we did 10 years ago, because we have access to much more information more easily. which is great for all of us. So we all feel like we are, like, you know, learning new things, experiencing new food, you know, eating more varied and so on. But if you take all of food culture and just lump it up, I would say that we probably have less variety now than we've ever had, because many more of us do the same stuff, a bit like I talked about in the beginning.
Right.
And I mean, on a personal level, I can feel that this is a little bit sad, because it's going to ultimately lead to a much less interesting eating world. But on the other hand, the individual has access to more diversity now, and you can't really argue that that's a bad thing.
Right. It's nice to be able to make spaghetti bolognese wherever you are on the planet.
It is.
But it's sad that you're not making what your
It's sad that we're all making spaghetti bolognese used to in a way.
Make or, you know.
It's very complex, that.
Yeah. Because, yeah, you talked a little bit about pleasure and why baking maybe connects us to the pleasure of actually doing it as opposed to the pleasure of eating it. If you look through the book, I mean, do we make it clear that all these photos are by Magnus, and they're really beautiful, and the book is beautifully illustrated. But I think if you know, as I was flipping through it, reading it in depth for this conversation, I think if you read between the lines a little bit, part of that pleasure is because if you look at those pictures, a lot of them are of a hearth, they're of a fireplace in a home kitchen. Even the illustrations of how you roll or tie a dough, it's very sort of intimate and real, and kind of, it does feel like it connects us to an older way of cooking.
Yeah.
There's no sous vide. There's no, I mean, you do allow that you can temper chocolate with microwaves, but there's something maybe about just the what you have to do or the trappings of baking that
I think,
happy.
But I think there's like a really important thing here is that all of those things, they might feel a bit old-fashioned, and some of them have been going on for a long time, but they're also all being practiced right now.
Right.
And I think that's what's unique with the Nordics, you know. And the people do bake, you know.
And
they really do.
Right. And for us...
You bake.
Not well, but... for us, it's a choice, though. I mean, you know, we're...
It's a choice for us, too.
Right.
But what used to be needed informs our choices today, which is... I mean, it's kind of stupid, really, if you think about it. Instead of using all of this variety that we have access to in our sort of privileged world, we just choose actively to do exactly what people had to do in the past and that they, you know, what they probably didn't want to do at all in the past.
Right. But they didn't
want to eat porridge in the morning.
Right. Or
but I want to do that. It's very strange, the whole thing.
Oh, the whole, yeah. so much of what you do at Favikin and so much of what you have in the books, it's celebrating things that used to be done because they were necessary, because they were about preserving for the long winters. But I think one of the pleasurable things about the book is just that, you know, you're saying that Americans don't have a very clear idea about what Scandinavian baking is, and you say... starting this process, that you were—I assume you mean with the first book too—that you were surprised by what you didn't know about your own culinary landscape. What with baking specifically? What surprised you, or what didn't you know?
I mean, with baking, I think it was just the most surprising thing was like just how much diversity that there was there, and how much I sort of didn't know about the baking culture of the other countries.
So my
knowledge, especially about sort of the neighboring countries of Sweden, was much more superficial than I expected it to be. Very sort of arrogantly Swedish, you know. But take Finland, for example, which has quite a few things in common with Scandinavia when it comes to the baking culture. But at the same time, it has so many recipes and traditions that don't exist anywhere else, and so many things that are, you know, that have much more in common with Russia, for example, or the Baltics, or and many things like that, you know, and also just how everything ties together.
Were there bigger surprises within the differences in baking within Scandinavia than versus savory food, or?
I think so. And like looking back, I think that I I mean, it's not much of a surprise, because if you think about the thing with the grains, for example, that, I mean, Finland has a whole baking culture based only on one grain. I mean, my part of Sweden has another baking culture based on a different grain, and so on. So all these circumstances obviously lead to a lot of diversity, and it's not particularly surprising when you know of them, but I'd never thought about it that way before. That, you know, these things that were necessary in the past still inform the way we choose to eat today to such a high extent, and thereby also informs, you know, what recipes are out there.
And do you think the sort of introduction of, you talk about how the introduction of industrialized yeast changed things in certain, in wheat-based regions, and the rye, people were sort of unimpressed.
Yeah, very unimpressed.
Didn't change the world.
That's actually something that's, I mean, it's tremendously interesting, because so before industrialization and before someone figured out how to process and produce yeast on an industrial scale, all baking was like slow ferments and sourdough, essentially. And then in these regions where many breads were wheat-based, when yeast was introduced as a commodity, I mean, imagine the difference. You know, for generations, you've made this bread for your family every day.
Waiting which
was like,
around.
It took 3 days to leaven. It was like this thick and, you know. and then you just added yeast. And the same thing, it took 45 minutes. And it was like fluffy, which was a texture you'd never seen before.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was very appealing, you know. Whilst in Finland, where it was only rye, rye has much less gluten than wheat, so they didn't get any fluff. I mean, they just got the same kind of, you know, not much happened. And also the carbohydrate chains are more complex in rye, and they break down in a different way. So, I mean, if you leaven a rye bread, pure rye bread for 45 minutes with yeast, it's like eating paperboard, you know?
It just doesn't improve.
So they were, like you say, very unimpressed with this yeast thing. And then they just kept their sourdoughs going. So today they still have like an unbroken track of using sourdough in their baking culture.
And does that extend to regional taste in other food? Is there a sort of bias against fluffiness in Jutland?
I think we're actually even more keen on fluffiness.
Oh, you're into it.
Culture in the past.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. No, I don't
know. You look for it.
Yeah, we like fluff.
Well, thank you to the JCC. And thank you all for coming out. And thank you, Magnus.
Thank you so much, John.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was chef and photographer Magnus Nilsson, who is currently head chef at the restaurant Faviken in Sweden, and whose latest book is The Nordic Baking Book. He was joined in conversation by Adam Sachs, former editor-in-chief of Saveur. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.